SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Hi, it's Noor Haider, one of the hosts of The Guardian's daily news podcast, Full Story. Every weekday, we bring you a single story, going beyond the headlines and taking you closer to The Guardian's journalism. Combining personal storytelling with analysis, we take you inside the stories that matter most. For fearless, independent reporting that holds power to account, listen to Full Story from The Guardian, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to SBS On The Money with Ricardo Gonçalves.
Hi everyone, welcome to the SBS On The Money podcast for this first day of winter, Monday the 1st of June 2026, and it's a day where the Australian share market finished flat ahead of GDP figures here later this week, along with job numbers out of the US. We'll have the details with Elio D'Amato soon from Enviro Invest, plus we'll find out from Colonial First State how much money Australians think they'll need in retirement. But first, the full extent of the federal budget changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax will take some time to flow through to the housing market, but higher interest rates and a slowing economy due to the war were already putting the brakes on price growth. Cotality says the median national dwelling price remained at nearly $942,000, but it really is a tale of two halves. Values in the West rose last month, the likes of Perth and Darwin, the best performing capitals, up 1.5%, while on the opposite side of the country, the southeast of the continent saw continued weakness, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. Tim Lawless warns national prices will start falling from next month, and Stephanie Youssef spoke with him.
So, Tim, why have national house prices stalled, and what does that signal about the broader housing market?
Well, I think that the trend has been leading to this. We've already been seeing housing price growth easing pretty much since November last year. So seeing a zero outcome for our national index in the month of May, I think it was just a matter of time. In fact, I think next month we'll probably see a negative result. Part of this is simply the cyclical factors. The market was highly unaffordable leading into the end of last year. But of course, since then, we've seen interest rates rise by 75 basis points. We've seen a global oil crisis. Confidence has plummeted. And now we're probably just starting to see the early signs of some negative influence on housing demand from the federal budget, particularly on confidence and sentiment.
Sydney and Melbourne are leading the downturn, while others in cities like Perth and Brisbane are still recording growth. Why is that, and could this be the start of a nationwide slowdown?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons here. I mean, Sydney and Melbourne do tend to lead the cycles, but I think the slowdown in these two markets, or the downturn, is for very different reasons. I mean, Sydney is extraordinarily expensive and unaffordable. You've got a median dwelling value in Sydney that's up around the $1.3 million mark. But also, I think the macro factors are playing out against both markets. Higher interest rates, lower sentiment, the budget decision, I think are all factors. Melbourne is just a very fragile market, it seems. The last 5 years, we've seen Melbourne housing values rise by less than 4%. So it's been a consistently weaker performing market, which I think reflects just low confidence and generally weaker state-level economic performance.
Are we seeing any evidence yet that the budget's tax changes are influencing buyer behaviour or housing prices?
It's hard to know what the budget influence has been so far. We're probably not seeing too much of it in our home value index so far, but we can probably see the immediacy in things like auction clearance rates, for example, which did fall post-budget. Last weekend, the early numbers came in at 54%, which was the lowest clearance rate we've seen since April of 2020, just as COVID was becoming a thing. So I think there's some clear indirect evidence that the budget's had a negative impact on sentiment, and we are expecting that'll flow through over the coming months. We are definitely expecting there to be a fairly sharp pullback in investment demand across the market, which, you know, leading into March, investors were about 41% of mortgage demand. So if we do see a sharp pullback in investors, like most people are expecting, that is a fairly large element of aggregate demand being removed from the market.
Supply levels are increasing with more listings across most markets. Are buyers finally gaining the upper hand?
I think, finally buyers have more choice. Even though it's only really Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra where listings are above average now, and these are the three markets where values were down over the month, those mid-sized capitals are seeing listings rising quite clearly. They're still below average, but a market like Brisbane, for example, the trend is very visible. We're now seeing listing numbers about 8% above where they were a year ago. And go back to the end of last year, each of those mid-sized capitals was seeing listings tracking anywhere between about 30 to 50% below their five-year average. They're much closer to average levels now, which I think for buyers is great news. It means there's more choice, there's less urgency, they can negotiate a little bit harder. After such a prolonged seller's market, we're probably now looking more towards a market that where buyers are back in the driver's seat.
Economists are pricing in one or two more interest rate hikes this year. How could that further impact housing values?
Higher interest rates would definitely be another downside factor for the housing market. It looks like we'll probably see a hold in June, which will be certainly well received. But I think if we do see rates going further upwards, clearly that's going to have a further erosion on borrowing ability or borrowing capacity and serviceability. So that would be another downside risk for the housing market.
That's Stephanie Youssef there speaking with Tim Lawless from Cotality. From the housing market, let's go to the share market, where the S&P ASX 200 finished flat, only down 2 points to 8,729. That's as Brent crude rebounded from last week's six-week low. Healthcare sector fell, but the tech sector rose and BHP hit a record high today. For more on the day's market moves, I spoke with Elio D'Amato from Enviro Invest. So Elio, May was a huge month for global equities, especially in the US with the NASDAQ surge 10.5%, the S&P 500 around 5%. What's driving investor sentiment at the moment? Because we've still got this conflict in the Middle East 3 months in.
Yeah, not to mention the cost of living pressures and a slightly strengthening US dollar. I mean, it's a case of bizarro world at the moment. Look, you know, if you ask me what is driving markets, my response is, you know, that investing is part science, but part art. And definitely we're seeing art ruling at the moment. I mean, I could give you 1,000 reasons why we should be, or why we shouldn't be invested, I should say, at the moment. And each of them, you know, really, well, look, optimism is very strong. I mean, to be quite frank and honest, I mean, yeah, there's bad news, but, and it's in that but carries a premium. I mean, we know things are not great. I mean, we see downgrades and the savage price declines that are occurring after them, but no one is brave enough to stand against any bull at the moment. And, look, when you suppose the data comes out that suggests that things are going to be okay, then, why not put the woes of the current world behind us and think about the future? And I think we're seeing a lot of that at the moment, and definitely sentiment is on the positive side.
I think when we talk about the US, we've seen corporate reporting season come and go and the numbers weren't too bad, right? We've now got some crucial jobs numbers coming out of the US and a potential huge SpaceX IPO. How are these likely to influence investors, and are these two events perhaps the key events coming up?
Yeah, well, in short answer, yes, they are. And it all adds to that but element that I was talking about earlier. I mean, look, US job numbers, if you can believe them, they'll probably look pretty good. Any new big IPO on the market is good for market sentiment. And because they haven't happened just yet and we're talking about it, that means that we expect that positive sentiment to continue. So how that's going to impact investors, in our view, quite positively across the board. The IPO will support the data and basically everyone's a winner.
Right. When you look at our share market, there seems to be lots of little bits of news coming through over today and the past few weeks. When you look at today, is there anything catching your attention?
Yeah, look, quite a bit, actually. I mean, we start with digital radiology software firm ProMedicus, who announced two new contracts today. And look, while the stock has fallen significantly from its highs back in July late last year, I mean, you know, it basically continues to trade at nosebleed levels. But really, at the end of the day, on the back of these announcements, we're talking about a bigger business today than it was back then, and yet it's half the price. So in our view, it's a bit of an opportunity for investors. Also, ReadyTech today, I saw they confirmed reports that they had received an unsolicited, non-binding indicative proposal for its business. Now, That was valued at some $2 per share. The board have obviously, as you would expect, knocked back that offer, though I didn't see them buy up when the stock was, you know, sub 120 back in April this year, actually. Another one, Vendia Services, they're up also because they got a 5-year extension worth around $133 million to basically continue managing the facility for the Marines, as it were, here in Australia, in WA. So that further confirms to us that, you know, the trials and tribulations of the past and previous investigations into bad business practices, they're somewhat over. Speaking of which, DroneShield also received a knock on its remuneration report, which saw its shares fall. Presumably because they didn't have, you know, they didn't start any conflicts. They just ultimately benefit from them. And really, investors ask, well, really, did they do anything that was strategically important?
When you look at the broader market, what are you telling your clients at the moment and where do you see the opportunities for investors?
Well, the first thing we're doing is we're telling them to close their eyes. And, you know, this might very well seem a little bit interesting to most, but we think of a world, you know, the future world, one where volatility doesn't exist. You know, we know that things are getting harder. We know that it's more difficult to make a profit these days, and that is going to remain, you know, in place for quite a while yet. So, you know, they need big earmuffs and back their research into who's going to be around in the future when the dust settles. So their portfolios need to reflect this in our view. Look for companies that are going to, you know, still be standing when that, we come out from our bunkers, as it were. Look, because, you know, ultimately you want businesses that can control their margins. They want to do that in this, you know, in an inflationary environment that we're experiencing at the moment. Anyone that can actually control their costs, in our view are going to be, trading at a premium and should be trading at a premium. So, you know, look at those consumer staple businesses. Look at IT businesses that have a say in their costs, in particular. Look, you know, and dare I say, if you're a contrarian, then look at property at the moment as well as look at healthcare, because they're going to be, again, when Armageddon's over, in our view, they're going to be your services that are still required and still needed. So, but recently they've suffered on the sentiment bandwagon, as it were, because at the moment everyone is looking at the top line. But the question is, how long will the music go for?
That's Ilya D'Amato there from Enviro Invest.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, and that's just the beginning. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you. Shopify, your all-in-one commerce platform.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com.au/listen.
Hi, it's Noor Haider, one of the hosts of The Guardian's daily news podcast, Full Story. Every weekday, we bring you a single story, going beyond the headlines and taking you closer to The Guardian's journalism. Combining personal storytelling with analysis, we take you inside the stories that matter most. For fearless, independent reporting that holds power to account, listen to Full Story from The Guardian, wherever you get your podcasts.
Got a question for you. How much do you think you need to retire comfortably? Well, a survey of nearly 2,000 Aussies found it's just over $1 million, and that's more than $183,000 more than a year earlier. This is what the Colonial First State team says, but it's more than what Supergroup ASFA says is needed at around $630,000 for home-owning singles, which we'll discuss in a few moments' time. The survey also found that Australians are having to work longer than they would like to ahead of retirement. So for more, I spoke with CFS Superannuation CEO Kelly Power. So Kelly, in broad terms, what surprised you, if anything, from these findings?
I think what I found most surprising was the 4-year gap between the aspiration of when Australians would like to retire, being age 62, and when they believe they will be able to retire, being age 66. So that 4-year gap was something that was quite surprising to me. In addition, the number of $1 million, so Australians thinking that they need that $1 million, you know, magic number when they hit retirement, and we've seen that number creep up, and I think that that really reflects what we're seeing today in terms of cost of living pressure and the mental load that that's having on people.
Can you put that $1 million into context? Are they perhaps overstating that number? And I ask that because we've seen ASPR's retirement standard, which says, you know, home-owning singles need around $630,000 to retire comfortably.
Yeah, look, it really does depend on individual circumstances. And you're right, that is that ASPR number for a comfortable retirement, around $600,000 for an individual. But it really does depend on your circumstances. If you are, if you own your own property, for example, you'll need less compared to if you need to pay rent. If you're a couple, if you have dependents living at home, your health conditions, et cetera. So it is really personal. I think what we're seeing in terms of that $1 million number is really that concern around cost of living and just that uncertainty, around, you know, health costs and living costs and food costs that's really driving that difference. What I would say, though, is that advice is critical. Personal circumstances are different for every individual. And if you can see an advisor or use free tools that are available online, you can get a real sense of what you need. In many cases, it's not as much as you think you might need.
What policy changes do you think are needed to kind of close the retirement preparedness gap?
Yeah, so one of the things that the industry has been really calling out for is more affordable financial advice for more Australians. And so that is a really critical and important part of policy change. We know that you're materially more prepared and feel more comfortable in, as you head into retirement if you've seen a financial advisor. It's something like 77% of people that seen a financial advisor feel prepared for retirement versus 45% where they haven't seen an advisor. So we know that getting advice is really, really critical. But again, it's not available to everyone and it can be quite unaffordable. And so one of the things that we've been calling out is for a reduction in the red tape and the compliance costs associated with providing advice so that we can broaden the number of Australians that can get access to that advice.
For those people who are close and concerned about retirement, what's the advice right now?
Yeah, so the good news is there's some really simple things you can do right now to give you a better level of comfort as you move into retirement. And the first one is just to take an active interest. So find out where your superannuation is, how much you have today. Make sure you don't have multiple superannuation accounts. Check that you're invested appropriately. There's some really good tools that are available to people on super funds like CFS. You can go online and there's free tools available that will tell you how much you might need in retirement and what that gap is, and some really simple strategies to close that gap, such as just making small contributions and, as I mentioned, seeing an advisor. And in many cases, you can pay for the cost of advice from your superannuation account, so you don't have to pay it as an out-of-pocket expense, making it much more affordable.
And just finally, back on that 1 million number, right? I'm a bit stuck on it because of that ASPR number, right? And I appreciate you said it also depends on an individual circumstance. We've also done stories in the past about people retiring, having this bank of superannuation and then dying with this lump sum. So they're not using this money in retirement, what it's there for. Is there perhaps that overestimation of how much is actually needed?
Well, for people, if you think about the emotional aspect of this, and we talk obviously to a lot of our members and retirees all the time, and it's the last dollar that they're ever going to make. So that concern around making sure it lasts is something that's really important to them. And again, many people will draw down less than they should and live more frugally in retirement because they don't have access to that help. Again, go to your super fund. They can provide you this help. They can tell you and help you manage that longevity risk. And again, many of them can help refer you, like in our case, to financial advisors. We work with a large panel of financial advisors who can support you in actually working out how long will my money last and how much can I spend on a month-by-month basis.
That is Kelly Power there from Colonial First State Superannuation. And she wraps up the podcast for this first day of winter. Monday, the 1st of June. If you enjoy it, give it a like, a review and subscribe. And don't forget, you can watch On The Money during the 6:30 weekday edition of SBS World News on SBS. The podcast returns tomorrow. It drops after the market close every weekday, and I'll catch you then.
This SBS On The Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only. The content on this podcast should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.
Noor Haider here, one of the hosts of The Guardian's daily news podcast, Full Story. Every weekday, we go beyond the headlines, taking you closer to The Guardian's journalism. Listen to Full Story wherever you get your podcasts.